These same people used the practice of disinformation, attacking their critics by saying that, you know, they misspoke and things like that. So it seems like they want a true one-way street.
The entire effort of the Department of Justice has undergone a significant evolution from the idea that we somehow existed so that we could prosecute crimes that had been committed to finding a way to prevent a crime from being committed.
Now, before the FBI can go in there, they have to get the approval of a judge. All they have to say is the magic words, "We are doing an investigation on international terrorism."
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, June 6th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Hamas quit talks today designed to halt anti-Israeli attacks, throwing the U.S.-backed peace plan into jeopardy. But Palestinian officials insisted a truce was still possible and pushed ahead with plans to get illegal guns off the streets, including a weapons buyback. As part of the U.S.-backed roadmap to Palestinian statehood, the Palestinians have to disarm and dismantle militant groups that have killed hundreds of Israelis in shootings and bombings in 32 months of fighting. A Florida judge ruled today that a Muslim woman cannot wear a veil in her driver's license photo, agreeing with state authorities that the practice could help terrorists conceal their identities. After hearing 3 days of testimony last week, Circuit Judge Janet C. Thorpe ruled that Sultania Freeman's right to free exercise of religion would not be infringed by having to show her face on her license. Thorpe said the state has a compelling interest in protecting the public from criminal activities and security threats, and having access to photo image identification is essential to promote that interest. Freeman, 35, had obtained a license in 2001 that showed her veiled with only her eyes visible through a slit. But after the September 11th attacks, the state demanded that she return to have her photo retaken with her face uncovered. She refused, and the state revoked her license. In October 2001, President Bush signed his name to H.R. 3162, a piece of legislation better known as the U.S. Patriot Act. Patriot is, in this case, an acronym for Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. The act was the administration's first strong legislative response to the devastating terrorist attacks, which rocked the nation only a month before. Addressing allegations that legal barriers kept vital counterterrorist information from being shared between law enforcement and intelligence agencies, the Patriot Act significantly expanded FBI power to investigate and detain indefinitely persons suspected of terrorism without the right to counsel or habeas corpus. Human rights groups at home and abroad have expressed their outrage over the 762 people held incognito by the Justice Department on charges of immigration violations and suspected ties to terrorism. 515 of those people have since been deported. In hearings before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday, Attorney General John Ashcroft proposed changes, including, among others, allowing capital punishment for all terrorist acts resulting in loss of life and making terrorism suspects ineligible for release on bail bond. He said that he had some sympathy for the criticism of the recent detentions, but nonetheless expressed his view that the Patriot Act needs to be strengthened.
Following September the 11th, the department consulted very extensively with this committee and members of Congress about the Patriot Act. In terms of the change in the guidelines which govern the internal operation of the Justice Department, the consultation was not substantial or significant. Perhaps I came to the conclusion that extending those guidelines in the same spirit as the Patriot Act had been extended was something that would be appropriate and would meet with the approval of the Congress. But I must say that we did not have extensive consultations about this exercise of executive responsibility to define the way in which the executive branch would conduct investigations.
Major difference between the Levy guidelines and the revision of August 2002 is that it allowed FBI agents to attend public events such as political demonstrations, meetings, and religious services, and to use data mining services without any previous evidence that a crime was in the process of being committed or there was a conspiracy to commit a crime. So that predicate was removed as a result of the revisions that were announced last August. On what basis will the determination be made that the purpose for attending the event or using the data mining service is to prevent or detect terrorism, and who will make that decision?
The entire effort of the Department of Justice has undergone a significant evolution from the idea that we somehow existed so that we could prosecute crimes that had been committed to finding a way to prevent a crime from being committed. We came to the conclusion rather quickly at 9/11 that waiting for a crime to be committed and then prosecuting was an inadequate way to protect the American people. When the perpetrators of the crime extinguished themselves purposefully in the commission of the crime, and when they extinguished the lives of 3,000 people in the commission of the crime, the potential for prosecution is not a very rewarding potential. So we had to make a shift in the way we thought about things. So being reactive, waiting for a crime to be committed, or waiting for there to be evidence of the commission of a crime didn't seem to us to be an appropriate way to protect the American people. So we had to develop guidelines that were well within the Constitution, clearly protected the rights of people in the Constitution, carefully did so. We just said that FBI agents could go to any public place that any other citizen could go to on the same terms and conditions as the public if they were seeking to prevent terrorism. We are not in the business of keeping records on individuals, and it is specifically prohibited in the guidelines that records would be kept for people for the exercise of their constitutional rights.
With 9/11, we are concerned about the way that you have used your power.
California Congresswoman Maxine Waters.
The way that you have detained immigrants, and we're increasingly concerned about the way that you use the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. When you answered some of the questions at page 2 of your prepared testimony, you state that the United States has deported 515 individuals linked to the September 11 terrorism investigation. I assume and certainly hope that if the department found that any of these 515 individuals were involved in terrorist activities, that the department would hold them, not simply deport them, from this country. Yet your testimony is that these 515 individuals were deported. So how are any of these individuals linked to the September 11th investigation? To the contrary, isn't it a fact that after you rounded up these individuals, you found that they had no involvement with terrorist activity, but found a problem with their immigration status that provided you a simple legal basis to support them? Is this what you mean when you say that these individuals were linked to the September 11th investigation? Simply that the roundups after September 11th set in motion a chain of events that caused you to discover problems with these persons' immigration status? When you answer that, please refer also to the Inspector General's report that talked about holding these people without charge for over a month in unconscionable conditions and them unable to contact an attorney or have a telephone call.
Let me say to you that we are very concerned about any time individuals are abused in the United States and their rights are not properly respected. You raised the question about individuals who were deported, who were individuals that were linked to the terrorism investigation. There are individuals who had strong links to the terrorists, against whom we did not have a case that was sufficient to bring criminal charges, or about whom the bringing of the case might result in the revelation of material in court which would be against the national security interests of the United States. None of the individuals that were the subject of the report of the Inspector General, none of those individuals was in the United States legally. All of them were illegally here. The policy of the department, for which we do not apologize, was that until individuals apprehended who are here illegally, who don't have a right to bail or bond, who are here illegally, before we would release them prior to their deportation, we wanted to have them cleared. The Inspector General indicated that there were some cases among the 700-plus individuals where there are accusations of abuse in the prison system. We do not stand for abuse, and we will investigate those cases. There are 18 cases that were brought to our attention. 14 of those cases have been investigated. The investigation is ongoing, although in 14 of those cases, the Civil Rights Division has indicated that it does not find adequate predicate to bring criminal charges in those cases. But the other four are going to be continued to be investigated. We don't tolerate violence in our prisons. Generally, we don't tolerate violence in holding individuals. That's not a policy of the department. And in those situations, we'll seek to correct those situations. But the Inspector General reminded us in previous reports that when people were not detained after they were apprehended as illegals in this country, 85% of them did not honor the deportation order. They just slipped back into society. We could not afford, in a setting where individuals were clearly associated with the investigation regarding terrorism, to let those individuals be back in the public so that 85% or more of them could merge back into the American culture.
U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft speaking in hearings before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz was erroneously credited with saying that oil was the reason the U.S. invaded Iraq by the U.K. Guardian newspaper at the Asia Security Conference in Singapore last week. When asked why the U.S. attacked Iraq and not North Korea, which has admitted to having nuclear capability, Wolfowitz said, quote, "The primary difference between North Korea and Iraq is that we had virtually no economic options in Iraq because the country floats on a sea of oil. In the case of North Korea," he said, "the country is teetering on the edge of economic collapse. That, I believe, is a major point of leverage." End quote. Today, The Guardian printed a correction saying that they mischaracterized Wolfowitz's statement by implying he said oil was the reason the U.S. invaded Iraq. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke with Wayne Mattson, author and reporter for Intelligence Online, who has written extensively about Wolfowitz. We asked him if he agreed that the U.S. had no economic recourse by which to pressure Iraq because of its vast oil reserves.
Actually, we had sanctions that were imposed by the United Nations on Iraq for several years, and this UN sanctions program resulted in needless deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children. So when Wolfowitz says there was no economic possibility to force Iraq to comply with U.S. or U.N. demands due to sanctions, I think he was flat out wrong.
But under U.N. resolutions, even though Iraq has major oil reserves, they were prohibited from selling oil and except in exchange for food and humanitarian supplies under the grounds of the Oil for Food program. Since Iraq was proscribed by the U.N. from benefiting from its oil reserves, where then was this tremendous wealth of which Wolfowitz was speaking?
Well, maybe he was talking about the people who actually did benefit from the restructuring of Iraq's oil infrastructure after the first Gulf War. And, of course, we know that one of the companies that benefited greatly from that was Dick Cheney's old company, Halliburton, and its construction arm, Brown & Root. It certainly wasn't the Iraqi children or many of the civilians who couldn't get medicine and food and other necessities. I don't know what Wolfowitz is talking about, because this is exactly what Wolfowitz says, what people said prior to the war, that this was over oil. And if North Korea was floating on a sea of oil, we probably would have been attacking Pyongyang rather than Baghdad.
The media has been accused of misquoting him by the right-wing website Cronwatch. They said that his statement wasn't exactly meant to say that oil was the reason the U.S. invaded Iraq, and this was originally reported by the Guardian newspaper, and they've since printed a correction and pulled the original article, saying that, well, when you look at it in context, Wolfowitz didn't exactly say that oil was the main reason the U.S. attacked Iraq. Are they just splitting hairs, or do you see a legitimate distinction?
It's amazing when Wolfowitz and this neoconservative crowd, when they're misquoted, of course, they want to carefully parse their sentences, and they say, oh, and they cry foul, we've been misquoted. I mean, President Bush mixes up the word continuous with contiguous, and the White House pulls his original transcript and replaces it. But then you see what happened prior to the war and after the war against Iraq. These same people used the practice of disinformation, attacking their critics by saying that, you know, they misspoke and things like that. So it seems like they want a true one-way street. They can attack critics of the policy, but when they're attacked because of what they say, oh, we were taken out of context. So I think this is a rather unusual, and Wolfowitz certainly seems to be playing that game more than most people in the Rumsfeld cabal, which is something they call themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't the first time Paul Wolfowitz has been entangled in potentially damaging statements that he's made. I know that his outspokenness troubled a lot of international observers, including another recent statement that he made that the weapons of mass destruction were merely a, quote, bureaucratic, unquote, excuse for waging war in Iraq. Just how significant are these sorts of statements coming from Wolfowitz, and how influential is he in the administration?
Well, Wolfowitz is basically the number two guy at the Pentagon. He's Rumsfeld's right-hand man, right in many ways. He's been accused of actually being to the right of Donald Rumsfeld, if that's even politically possible. But yes, the Wolfowitz statement that hitting Iraq with the charge that they had weapons of mass destruction, he said, well, we could all agree on that. It seems like this Iraq policy was not based on anything other than the fact that the Bush administration wanted us to get into this war, and they invented weapons of mass destruction, where even the Defense Intelligence Agency today leaked a confidential report that in September last year, they had no reliable information about any Iraqi chemical or biological weapons of mass destruction. So there just isn't any there when Wolfowitz makes these claims.
But I know historically and sort of politically, the Deputy Secretary of Defense usually hasn't been that powerful of a figure and had this much influence, and people hardly even knew his name in the past. So how is this different with Wolfowitz?
Well, Wolfowitz definitely has a long academic background. He was with Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He used that to write a lot of papers. Much of the policy we see right now, this is going to be a new American century. The U.S. will impose its traditions and political philosophy on other countries. Some of these policies come right out of things that Wolfowitz has written about in the past. So he's got a very long track record because he is an academic, after all. But unlike many academics, it seems like his papers are now becoming actual U.S. policy.
And you've written a lot about him as well. I know you've investigated his background. You wrote an article recently on Wolfowitz's adaptation of the philosophy of Leo Strauss, a former professor of his and an important right-wing thinker, the philosophy that it's not only desirable to lie to the masses, but in fact necessary to do so for their own protection. In an interview with Vanity Fair, soon to be released, Wolfowitz plays down the role that Strauss played, though, in shaping his own, the formation of his own ideas. And he said that he only took two classes under Strauss, one on Montesquieu and the other on Plato's Law. So you've written a lot on this subject. How influential do you think this whole Straussian philosophy is to Wolfowitz and other significant, you know, figures in the administration?
Well, I think when you listen to Wolfowitz make excuses, say, well, I only took a couple of courses under Strauss. As you say, Strauss is philosophy was based on using the big lie. It's okay to lie as long as you can achieve your ultimate aims. Now, some people would say that's Machiavellian. Other people would say that's more like Joseph Goebbels. He's actually using the big lie that he subscribes to explain away that, you know, hey, look, Strauss is no big deal. But these are the people that are cooking the intelligence. This was the group that forced Colin Powell to read a statement before the UN Security Council. One of the, I guess, original drafts, Powell just threw the paper up in the air and said, I'm not going to read this BS. You see the Straussians basically all throughout the administration, whether they took him.
So some critics of the left, I know, have said, well, you know, the left is just talking about Leo Strauss, talking about the neoconservatives, you know, involved with all these conspiracy theories. But looking at foreign policy directives today with Iraq and now in regards to Syria, North Korea, Iran and so forth, you really see this policy and this type of thinking permeating foreign policy?
Oh, definitely. And if you look at the past of the Bush administration, the use of the big lie, first of all, weapons of mass destruction haven't been found. Saddam Hussein was linked to al-Qaeda. Laughable. That was never proven. And the other issue was, remember the Coalition of the Willing. Some of the countries on the Coalition of the Willing said, hey, we had no idea we were members of the Coalition of the Willing. So you see lie after lie being perpetrated by this administration to justify the war against Iraq and other measures it's taking. Now that we're getting into the 2004 presidential election cycle, you have Paul Wolfowitz and you have another person, Karl Rove, who likes to use the politics of distortion and attacking political opponents. I think we all have to be very much aware of the use of the big lie, whether it's in foreign policy or as we get into the presidential election cycle in the political campaign.
Wayne Madsen is a former national security agent and a Washington reporter for Intelligence Online, and he's also the author of America's Nightmare, the Presidency of George Bush II. He was speaking with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian. How does our nation fight terrorism without undermining the Constitution? Stephen Rohde, host of Clear and Present Danger from our Civil Liberties desk here at Peace Watch, talks with Congressman Bernie Sanders, an independent congressman from Vermont, about a dangerous section of the Patriot Act and how passing the Freedom to Read Protection Act is an important first step in regaining our civil liberties.
Congressman Sanders, in the wake of 9/11, the country was in turmoil, in fear, some in hysteria. And shortly after that, the USA Patriot Act was offered by the Justice Department and swept through Congress with only a few no votes, including yours. Today, I wanted to talk to you about a particular section of the USA Patriot Act known as Section 215. Could you describe those provisions for us?
Sure. The section that we are focusing on, Section 215, gives the FBI tremendous latitude in terms of going into a library and saying to the librarian, we want a list of the books that John Smith has taken out. We want to monitor the internet sites that John Smith is visiting. And they can do the same at bookstores. And this is a direct result of Section 215. In the past, what the FBI was required to do, which I think is absolutely appropriate, is that if they had evidence that Mr. Smith was involved in terrorist activity, they had the right to go in and get that information. But they had to establish a level of probable cause. Right now, for all intent and purposes, all that the FBI has to do is walk into the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is a secret court, and say, we are doing an investigation on international terrorism. And they are doing investigations. Having said that, the judge has no option but to say, yes, you can go in and investigate the records of John Smith or Mary Jones or anybody else. So it is allowing the FBI to engage in a fishing expedition, and librarians and booksellers all over this country are outraged by this provision because what they fear is that the American people will suddenly start looking over their shoulders in terms of what they're reading. And this will be a real blow against intellectual curiosity and freedom, which is what this country is supposed to be about.
The target of the search warrant, must that person be suspected of a crime?
No. That's the point. Frankly, I am concerned about terrorism, and I think all of us want the government to do a strong job in protecting this country. If the FBI believed that John Smith or anybody else was involved in terrorist activity, and they had probable cause that he was involved and they wanted information to learn more about his activities, I could support that. That's historically what good law enforcement is about. But right now, all that the FBI has got to say is, we are doing an investigation on international terrorism, and we want his records, his reading habits. That's it. So you do not need to establish a probable cause.
Most Americans believe that the strength of our Constitution is in our checks and balances, in the role of our courts to be an independent judge over whether or not the executive is exercising its powers properly. What does Section 215 do as far as judicial oversight is concerned?
It essentially takes it away, and that's a good point. Now, the Department of Justice, per se, has been on the defensive lately on this issue, because not only are 105 members of Congress supporting this legislation to repeal this section, not only have 112 cities and towns all over this country passed resolutions expressing concern about this or that aspect of the Patriots Act, but you have the American Librarians Association, you have the American Booksellers Association, you have all kinds of organizations now speaking out in opposition to aspects of the USA Patriot Act and in support of this legislation. So what the Department of Justice is saying, among other things, well, now, before the FBI can go in there, they have to get the approval of a judge. Yeah, they do, but it's simply a technicality because the judge has virtually no discretion. All they have to say is the magic words. We are doing an investigation on international terrorism. And let me tell you, as everybody knows, The FBI is doing many investigations on international terrorism. So essentially, the judge's power of discretion has been taken away.
Well, the FBI in its recent report suggested they've got over 4,500, quote, terrorism investigations going on. So any one of those could lead to multiple search warrants.
Absolutely. You've raised a good point, because when we talk about separation of powers, what people historically say, well, a judge will not allow the FBI to do it unless they have reasonable suspicion, probable cause. But for all intent and purposes, and why we are so concerned about this provision in Section 215, the judge's discretion has been taken away.
Now, you've referred to legislation to repeal Section 215 as it relates to bookstores and libraries. What's the name of that bill, and what would that do?
It's the Freedom to Read Act, and it would repeal that section as it applies to libraries and bookstores. What it would mean is that if the FBI wanted to go into a library, it would have to show probable cause. And we'd be back to good old strong law enforcement, which I think most of us believe in.
So the Freedom to Read Protection Act would roll back the law to the way it existed for bookstores and libraries before 9/11.
That is correct.
And how many sponsors have you
gained? Well, the good news is, you know, I think when we began this process, and let me give you a little bit of history, if I might, about the process. I, as I mentioned before, voted against the USA Patriot Act because I had concerns about various aspects of it. But a few months ago, a group of librarians in my state of Vermont came into me, and having written a very strong letter, they said, Bernie, did you know that the FBI would have this power in terms of the people we lend books to or the booksellers sell books to? And in addition to that, we as librarians are complicit in this operation because we cannot tell the person who is being investigated that that is the case. So they were, A, concerned about this attack on basic civil liberties, and they were concerned that they themselves could end up in jail if they defied the FBI request. So with the support of the Vermont librarians, and we had the Vermont Booksellers Association, that concept spread nationally. We now have the support of the American Booksellers Association, the American Librarians Association. They have done a very good job in putting pressure on members of Congress, and we now have 105 members. And we're moving a lot faster than I thought we would, because it is not the easiest thing in the world for a member of Congress to be subjected to the charge that you're soft on terrorism. Well, nobody is soft on terrorism. Everybody understands the very serious dangers this country faces. But the bottom line here, and I hope that all Americans agree with this, is A, we have got to fight terrorism, but you have to do it without undermining the Constitution of the United States and the basic freedoms that make this country a great country.
Now, Section 215 had a second, almost ominous provision, which imposed a gag order on the bookstores or libraries.
Absolutely. That is them.
Would you explain that
sure.
for us?
FBI gets the warrant from the judge. They walk into your bookstore, they walk into your library, and they say, we want the records of what John Smith, Mary Jones has, the books they've taken out or the books they've purchased. And it would be against the law for that bookseller or that librarian to say, oh, by the way, John, the FBI was in here. They now know the books that you're reading. So that's an additional concern, obviously, that librarians have.
Decent law-abiding Americans shouldn't have to worry if they have their book buying and book borrowing records exposed. What do decent law-abiding Americans have to worry about in this law?
There are decent law-abiding citizens in China, and there are decent law-abiding citizens in many authoritarian countries. And by being decent and law-abiding, they obey the laws of governments that do not particularly believe in freedom. Our country is based on a constitution which at its heart and soul is privacy, is the right to do what we want to do if we're not impinging on other people's rights or hurting other people. So the issue is not law-abiding people don't have to worry. The point is that in a free society, will you accept the government looking over your shoulder in terms of what you are reading? People read different books for a dozen different reasons. And I think that most Americans want the right to know that what they're reading is their business and not the United States government's business. As I mentioned earlier, I think the fear that many librarians have is that this really has a chilling impact on intellectual curiosity. That if some young person takes out a biography of Osama bin Laden, is somebody going to think that they are sympathetic to Osama bin Laden. If somebody is gay and doesn't want the whole world to know about it and reads books on homosexuality, do they want the government to know about it? And I think on a broader issue, the whole issue of privacy in our country and the fact that every corporation in America knows, you know, the medicine that you're using or where you're spending your money on your credit card or what illnesses you may have is of great concern. And we want to address that. But I think it's safe to say, I think that most Americans would like the freedom to read the books that they want to read without Uncle Sam knowing about it.
You've already gained bipartisan support for your bill, isn't that right?
We have. And the truth is, I am a progressive and I'm the only independent in the Congress. But any honest conservative is forced to acknowledge that the USA Patriot Act is far from conservative legislation. The essence of conservatism is you don't want the government intruding on people's lives. Conservatives, my view is different. They don't want government involved in health care. They don't want government involved in education or minimal government involvement. Well, if you hold that view and you're consistent, you damn well don't want the United States government to be monitoring your reading habits. And when we introduced this legislation, we introduced it with a gentleman from Texas, Ron Paul, who is a very, very conservative fellow. But he is consistent and he is honest. He and I disagree on a million issues. But he is honest and consistent and does not want the federal government monitoring the reading habits of his constituents. And we have a number of conservative Republicans on board. Not enough. And we're going to work on that. But I think honest conservatives should be supporting this legislation.
Are you aware of any companion bill or anyone who will sponsor companion legislation in the Senate?
Yes. Senator Barbara Boxer of California will be introducing very similar legislation.
Now, your bill is H.R. 1157.
Yes.
But it does one other significant thing I was interested to see in reading it. It has an accountability provision which goes far beyond even the protection of libraries and bookstores.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Well, thank you for asking about that, because that's a very important part of the legislation. One of the concerns that many members of Congress have, including those who have voted for the USA Patriot, who still support it, they want to know what the government is doing. Well, they've written to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice is saying, sorry, it's confidential. We're not telling you. Well, we thought we were there to represent the people of America. That was what we kind of thought. So what we are being very clear about in this legislation is making the administration, any Department of Justice, accountable to the United States Congress so we know what they are doing.
What can Americans do to support the Freedom to Read Protection Act?
Well, what they can do is urge their members of Congress and members of the Senate to support it. They can work with their local librarians who are doing a fantastic job. There are some librarians here in California who have put posters up in libraries warning people that the government may be monitoring their reading habits. They can be supporting their local booksellers, and the American Booksellers Association has done a great job as well. But I think we live in dangerous times, and when people get frightened, sometimes the first thing that goes out the window are basic constitutional rights. That's been the history of our country, unfortunately. We have seen this through McCarthyism. We saw this in the 1960s. We saw it in World War II. We saw it in World War I. But I think that very strongly, I believe, and I think most Americans believe, yes, we've got to wage the strongest effort we can against terrorism, protect the American people. But as a free nation, let us not undermine the Constitution when we go about doing that. We can fight terrorism and we can defend our constitutional rights at the same time. And I hope, to answer your question, that as many citizens as possible will become engaged in this issue.
Finally, Congressman, our program is called Clear and Present Danger. What do you think today is the most clear and present danger to freedom of expression in the United States?
Well, I think we have an administration which, quite frankly, has an attorney general that was one of the most right-wing members of the United States Senate when he was there. And I think we have a president who are not great supporters of civil liberties. I am concerned about deregulation in the media and fewer large corporations controlling what we see, hear, and read. I'm concerned that the administration is very reluctant to release information about what it is doing. So I would hope very much that all patriots who are listening to this program understand that what being a patriotic American is about is defending freedom, defending diverse points of view, the freedom to dissent. That's what America is about. And what's happening today concerns me very much, which is why I hope people will be actively involved in this struggle.
Congressman, when they write Profiles in Courage of this era, I think there's going to be a chapter on you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Clear and Present Danger with host Stephen Rohde. The show is a production of PEN USA and Pacifica Radio Archives. The executive producer of this segment is Deborah Jones. Eileen Moskowitz is the producer. The editor is Mark Torres. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment. I'm